Welcome to the sixth presentation, and this our seventh series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster Haiwan Wan and our reference coordinator Brian Carson. Daniel Peach designed our posters. Our speaker tonight is a native of Cincinnati, where his family has lived for generations. He's a product of parochial schools and aspired to be a baseball player, especially a Cincinnati Red when he was younger. He attended Indiana University, graduating with a degree in English, becoming one of Garrison Keillor's English majors, and began his lifelong quest to find a job that would pay a lot for doing a little work. He says he's still looking. Along the way, he's worked as a delivery driver, janitor, AV grunt in the library, bartender, bookstore clerk, and telemarketer. However, an academic career beckoned, and he returned to graduate school, receiving an MA from Miami University of Ohio and his PhD from the University of Cincinnati. He joined the faculty at WKU, where he teaches English and creative writing. His short fiction, interviews, and book reviews have appeared in journals and anthologies like Backward City Review, Western Humanities Review, Halloween Horror, and Tales of Suspense. In his first novel, The Condemned, published in 2008, he describes a dying city where the mindless living dead rule the urban night. His second novel, The Girl in the Woods, published last year, is a fast-paced thriller about two missing girls, which has kept me up late the past several nights. Both are published by Delirium Press. When not teaching or writing, David enjoys reading, watching movies, and walking through cemeteries. He says he hopes to be the first person to get out of life alive. Please give a warm welcome to David Bell.
This happened, and the police and the FBI investigated, and like I said, to some extent, the story became national news, right? I heard about it where I was living in Ohio. And it was easy to see why this story would have resonated with me in some way, because I thought about my time in college and living in Bloomington as being a safe, happy time, right? A carefree time. Actually, when I was there, I didn't feel that carefree because I was an English major and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. But looking back, compared to my life now, I realize I was carefree back then. I'm happier now. I'm happier now, but more carefree, if that makes sense in some way. So I think about that as being this safe place where I was carefree and I had this nice life. And for something like that to happen there seemed very strange to me. You know, it seemed like it disturbed some notion that I had of the way the world was. So through the magic of the internet, I was able to follow the story. Through the Bloomington paper, I was able to read it online. And as I was reading the articles every day about what was happening and whatever, another story broke, I remember seeing another story one day. And this was a story about a missing persons case that happened in 1977, that in 1977, March of 1977, a IU student named Margaret Hayes was living in a rooming house off campus, and one night about 11 o'clock, she left the rooming house. She took just enough money to buy cigarettes. She left her glasses, her wallet, her clothes, everything she owned in the room, and she brought just enough money to buy a pack of cigarettes up on the corner. And she never came back. There were no witnesses. Nobody heard a scream. There was nothing, absolutely nothing. And at the time I read the story, it had been 23 years since Margaret Hayes had disappeared. And they interviewed her parents in the article, and her parents talked about how after 23 years, they were still living with this blank spot in their life. They didn't know what had happened to their daughter. They had this... just this empty space. They could sort of Sometimes their imagination took over and they wondered about what happened, but they had just kind of lived with this emptiness in their life as a result of it. So all that was left of this woman was on a there are tons of missing persons websites that you can go to, and she's on there. There's this picture of her on there, and it's kind of this grainy 70s picture. You know, she looks like someone from the 70s. She has her long hair parted in the middle, and she's wearing a big turtleneck and all that kind of stuff. And she looks normal in that way, but that's all that's left of her right now, really, as far as the rest of the world is concerned. So now, maybe as I talked about those cases, as you listened, right, I don't know, maybe you felt a little, I don't know, did you get a little tingle at the base of your neck? Did you feel a little feeling between excitement and fear or something like that? Maybe it was gas, but maybe it was a result of this story. You know, maybe you felt that little feeling of titillation that comes from something that doesn't quite make sense or doesn't quite add up. And if you didn't get that feeling, that's fine, because I did, and I always get that feeling when I think about cases like this. And I think it's that feeling that I want to talk about tonight to some extent, right? Maybe it's that feeling that drives me to write what I write, that little thrill that makes me want to write what I write about. I always tell my students, some of whom are here tonight, right, because you can't get enough of me in class, right? So you have to come out on a Thursday night. Don't worry, we'll be home in time to see Project Runway. It'll be okay. But I always tell my students that it's important for them to know who they are as a writer. I always say that we all tell the same story over and over again, right? It might not be the same story in the sense of what the plot is and all that, but it's emotional autobiography, right? We're all writing about the same thing over and over again. Maybe your parents got divorced when you were a kid. Maybe one of your parents died when you were a kid. Maybe your family moved away when you were a kid, right? Someone got sick, something happened to you. And that's always there. You know, we carry these things, these formative experiences with us, and they show up in our writing. Whether we're aware of it or not, if you look back at some point, it's there. And so that sort of gets to the question of why does someone write what they write, okay? Now, Stephen King has an answer to this question, because people always ask him, why do you write what you write? And there's an implication, of course, in that question, which is, why do you write the weird shit that you write, right? Why are you so twisted, or whatever the case may be? There also might be a little bit of a judgment in that, too. Why do you write the stuff that you write? And I like King's answer to the question, which is, he answers them with a question of his own, which is, what makes you think I have a choice about what I write? Right? And so I like that, and that's a good place to start. Does a writer choose her material, or does the material choose the writer? It's kind of a chicken and an egg question, right? Are we born a certain way, and do we see the world a certain way? Or are we shaped a certain way by our experiences, and then therefore we end up writing certain things? So think about that. Why do we write what we write, and how does that come about, right? Now, as I started at the beginning, I was talking about these missing persons cases, right? And how, if a different person had seen that material, they might have responded in a different way to the book. Somebody else might look at it and think of something else, right? They might write some sort of like social history of a small town or something like that. But I saw this, and this is what I thought about writing. So I'm just going to read a small passage from The Girl in the Woods from the very beginning, and all you really need to know is that Diana, the protagonist, has walked out her apartment door one morning, and there's a woman who she doesn't know out there, a strange-looking woman is out there on her porch saying that she wants to talk to Diana because she needs her help with something. And so they've gone to a diner to talk about this, and so we're just going to we'll join the conversation already in progress, as we say in the news business, right? But this is the conversation that they have, and it sort of shows the beginning of what I'm doing with these missing persons cases, right? Okay. Diana started to get the feeling that their conversation wasn't leading in the direction that she originally suspected. That Kay Todd hadn't sought her out because of her connection to the police department, but because of something else. Diana is a former police officer. And that uncertainty, that lack of confidence in the direction of the conversation, made Diana uneasy. What year did your daughter disappear, Kay? 1984. March of 1984. 25 years? 25 and a half, Kay said. You probably weren't even born then, were you? No, I wasn't. It feels like a lifetime since I saw her, Kay said. A couple of lifetimes. So why are you bringing it up now? Diana asked. I have lung cancer, she said. Inoperable. The doctor says 8 months, maybe a year. My other daughter, Daphne, died 2 years ago. Ovarian cancer. It runs in our family, apparently. And my mother died of it, too. I'm sorry, Diana said again. She sometimes felt as though it was all she could say to the Kay Todds of the world. I'm sorry. Sorry for the hand they've been dealt. Sorry that the world isn't fair. Sorry that whatever God hands out the breaks and the advantages, hands them down with all the care and the foresight of an overgrown, temperamental child. I'm sorry. I want to know something before I go, Kay said. I want to know what happened to my Margie. For a long time, I thought she was still alive. I believed it. I could feel it in my heart. And lately, I'm not so sure. I don't feel her anymore the way I used to, the way I always did since I carried her inside me. She licked her lips. Do you still feel your sister, Diana? Do you still think she's alive? So I'll stop there for a minute, but Diana's sister has disappeared before the book has opened, and so she's on a quest to find out what happened to her sister, and now she gets drawn into this quest for these other missing women, right? And I'll leave it to you to figure out if they're all connected or anything like that. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about sort of my formative years and the shaping of me as a writer. I have a confession to make, right, which might seem like an odd confession, given the kinds of things that I write about, right? But I am a recovering chicken, okay? In my childhood, I was afraid of everything, okay? Everything. Now, the first time I really, really remember being scared, all right, my earliest recollection of being scared happened when I was about 3 or 4 years old, okay? I'm not sure exactly, but I was about 3 or 4 years old. My brother is 8 years older than I am, okay? And one night my parents were going out. Now this in and of itself would be newsworthy information, because I don't think my parents have left the house since then. But one night my parents were going out and they left me in the care of my brother, who was 8 years older than I was. And he came up to me and he was very enthusiastic and he said, David, we are going to watch something really cool on TV tonight, okay? Now, if you have an older sibling, right, like, you know, if you're a guy and you have an older brother, you know, this is a big deal, right, to have your brother. Normally you're a pest, right, but if you have your brother say, we're going to do something cool together, okay, this is a big deal. So I was all in. I didn't care what we were doing. I was going to follow my brother wherever he wanted to take me, right? Now, it turns out we ended up watching a movie called The Thing with Two Heads. Has anybody seen this? Most of you are too young. Has anybody remembered this movie? Okay, The Thing? You do? Okay, there we go. It really is one of the worst movies that has ever been made, okay? Absolutely. In it, a rich white guy played by Ray Milland, who actually won an Academy Award like way back in the 40s or 50s. This was at the end of his life. He plays a rich white bigot, and he's dying. And he has invented this technology where you can transplant heads onto other bodies to keep people alive, right? So they need a body to transplant his head onto. So they find this guy who is on death row, and he's about to go to the electric chair. This huge black guy who was played by Rosie Grier, And some of you know who Rosie Grier is. Back in the 50s and 60s, or was it the 60s, right? Rosie Grier was a great, great NFL football player, right? Played for the Rams, right? A great, great NFL player. Now, after that, he became a minister, and he did. His claim to fame in more recent time is that he counseled O.J. Simpson in jail when O.J. was the first time O.J. was in jail. So Rosie Grier, but he's one of those athletes who decided to have an acting career, right? You can imagine how good an actor he really was. So they transplanted Ray Milland's head onto Rosie Grier's body, right? So it was this two-headed thing. So you had Rosie Grier, and this was before CGI. So you just had, if you go look at it on YouTube, you can see the preview for it. You had Ray Milland, like they were in a giant suit, and like Ray Milland's head was right here, right? And what happens is that because Rose, it's sort of a Frankenstein kind of story, I guess, because Rosie Grier is this death row inmate, right, he goes on a murderous rampage and all hell breaks loose, right? Now, it sounds ridiculous, and you're laughing at it, right? I was absolutely terrified beyond belief by this movie, okay? After I saw that movie, I laid in bed at night. I thought that the thing with two heads was going to come through the door or come through the window, right? I slept with a nightlight. I slept with the lamp on. I slept with the overhead lights on. You could have done surgery in my bedroom, right? And it still wasn't enough to bring me comfort. I was so terrified by this movie. The only thing that actually eases my pain is sort of thinking about the trouble that my brother probably got in for showing me this movie. But this became a pattern in my childhood. If I saw something scary on TV, if I read about something scary, I internalized it, right? For instance, I can very clearly remember hearing about a plane crash on TV, right, on the news or whatever. And I really thought, you know, when I was trying to go to sleep at night sometimes, I would think, those plane crash victims are under my bed, right? Or are in the closet or something like that. I once saw a show about Bigfoot. In the 70s, you know, there was a Bigfoot phase and a UFO phase. All this stuff was happening, right? I saw this show where Bigfoot came up to a house and attacked a house. And there's this very vivid thing that I remember where Bigfoot put his fist through the window.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm not crazy.
Okay. I was there too.
You were okay. See, it's actually based on a real case where these people in the woods claim that Bigfoot attacked their cabin, whatever. But I couldn't let go of that. I would sit there and I grew up in Ohio, and there aren't many Bigfoot sightings in Ohio. Especially in, like, we live very close to the city. We didn't even have deer. You know, all we had were, like, possum and stuff like that. But I was convinced, as I would sit there at night watching TV or whatever, I was convinced, you know, and then we had a big window in our living room. I was convinced that big hairy fist was going to come through the window some night and come at me, right? So I was a chicken. And none of this is, I don't think, unusual, right? A lot of kids go through this. A lot of kids get scared. A lot of kids sleep in their parents' room from time to time, or they sleep with the lights on, or they sleep with the nightlight. It's not that unusual. But what happened to me, and this probably also happens to a lot of kids, was that eventually, you know, my parents started saying, you can't watch these things, right? There was this, you know, censorship going on for their own sanity, right? Because I would wake them up in the middle of the night. As a kid, I didn't understand. I thought, well, mom and dad are at my beck and call, right? If I want to wake them up at 4 a.m. and say, I'm scared, I would do it. Now I understand as an adult, and this is why I don't have children, what it would be like if someone was waking me up at 4 a.m. every night or climbing into bed with me, whatever. So there was forbidden fruit, right, where that I wouldn't get to touch, I wouldn't get to look at, right? And so I think that stuck with me. There was kind of this thing where I wanted these things, but they weren't allowed, I wasn't allowed to have them. And then to continue on with this just a little bit, I think we as a society, we have an uncomfortable relationship with death and things like that. We're removed from it these days. We try to sanitize it, and we try to hold it at a distance from us. But it wasn't always that way, right? It used to be people would have their elderly relatives live with them, you know? And people didn't go to nursing homes as much, and people would die at home. And when I was a kid, my grandmother, my mother's mother, lived with us. And she lived with us just because she was old. She was a widow. My grandfather died long before I was born. She didn't have a lot of money, okay? And she needed someone to care for her. And when I was a kid, my mom didn't work outside the home when I was really small. So my grandmother lived with us, and my grandmother actually died in our house. And I remember the day she died very vividly. It was a Sunday morning, and my dad was out of town on a business trip. And because of that, I had come down and I was in my parents' bed that morning. If you're a Freudian, you can do something with that later. But I was there, and my grandmother slept in the room across the hall from my parents' bedroom. And my grandmother called out, and she said she was going to get up, which she wasn't allowed to do, or she wasn't able to do on her own, right? And we heard her fall. We heard her collapse in the other room. And I remember standing in the doorway of that bedroom and seeing my grandmother face down on the floor and my mom standing over her saying, "Mom, Mom," right? And my grandmother not moving. This was when I was 6 or 7 years old, I think. And I remember that we called the life squad, and I very clearly remember that my mom told my brother, the same one who showed me the thing with two heads, my mom told my brother, go out in the yard and make sure they know which house to come to and all that, right? And I remember that I had these pajamas that I wore when I was a kid. Actually, I still wear them sometimes. I had these pajamas that had baseball players on them, right? And I remember, what's that?
Onesie.
It was a onesie, yes. Okay, it wasn't. Don't visualize that. I'm talking about my grandmother dying. For God's sake. A little respect. Anyway, I was wearing my little baseball pajamas, right? And I remember one of the paramedics coming into our living room and saying to me, "Hey, buddy, you know, do you always play baseball in your pajamas?" I remember that very clearly and thinking that was funny. I remember my aunt and uncle coming to the house afterwards, you know. I remember, think about what it's like the first time you see adults cry, you know. That's sort of a world-shattering thing, like adults cry too. I thought only little kids cried, right? So seeing that, my aunt and my uncle and my mom and all that, I remember the coroner coming or the undertaker guy coming and going over all the paperwork with my mom and all that. I even remember going out later in the day in the neighborhood and playing with my friends and someone's coming up to me and saying, "Well, what happened at your house this morning?" Because there was a life squad there and all that. And just very casually, the way little kids would say, I said, "Oh, my grandma died," right? Just like I was unaffected by this and this was no big deal. But I have all these vivid, this was over 30 years ago, right? I have all these vivid memories of that day and these events, but there's something that I don't remember. There's a gap in my memory. There's a blank spot there that I don't remember. It's sort of like the Watergate tapes, right? Something's been erased, or I wasn't allowed to see it. I don't remember them taking my grandmother's body out of the house. They did take her out at some point, right? I assume that what happened is that my mom probably sent me upstairs with my brother or my sister or something like that, so it was out of the way. But I absolutely don't remember that at all. I have these very vivid memories of this, but I don't remember that at all. And I'm just wondering, does that fuel my curiosity a little bit? That, again, it's an example of saying, you know, to a certain extent, this is okay to see or to be around, but at some point, you're not allowed to know about these things, or at another point, you're not allowed to see these things. I was allowed to go to funerals because I went to my Uncle Bill's funeral when I was even younger than that, right? And I remember seeing him in the coffin and all that kind of stuff. But at some point, these things were not, I was not allowed to know these things, right? To add something else to the story, a few years after my grandmother died, I got my own room in our house. The room she died in, with the same carpet, because I remember that it was the 70s, so we had this like disgusting orange carpet, And I, you know, that image I have of seeing my grandmother on the floor, I remember the carpet, and then I moved into the room, and I had the carpet there. The carpet's probably still there, I don't know. But think about it, do you think I spent some nights thinking about that when I was laying in my bed, you know, with all the lights on, right? So there you go. Things that are kept from us, things that are forbidden from us, and things that maybe they make us more fascinated. Now, there's another trauma that I suffered in my childhood talking about this sort of stuff. Now, I'm going to talk about it. It's not the trauma that's been in the news about this organization, so just put that out of your mind right now. But I did suffer a trauma in my childhood that I think in a roundabout way affects the kinds of things I write about and the way I see the world, and that trauma is that I was raised Roman Catholic. Right. Now I'm joking a little bit, but when I look back on my Catholic upbringing, I realize, any Catholics in the audience? Anyone who's willing to admit it? Okay, just a few. Okay. Recovering Catholics, or are you still Catholic? You're recovering. Okay. What's that? X. Well, that's the same thing. You'll always be recovering. So when I look back on my Catholic upbringing, I realize what a violent, somewhat horrifying religion this is, at least as it was presented to me. Now, my version of the conversion of Catholicism that I was raised on, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about hell or damnation or anything like that. That wasn't really a big threat to us, going to hell or whatever. That wasn't part of it. We actually spent a lot more of our time focused on the awful things that happened to people on Earth while they were still alive. And usually these were the good people I'm talking about who suffered the most, right? Now, it starts with the crucifixion, right? This horrific death that Jesus suffered. When I grew up, I attended this old, old church, which I think, see, I'm not Catholic anymore, really, but I'm a hypocrite because I'm also sort of disdainful to the way the church has evolved since I was a kid. Like, the church has kind of become, I don't know. I was going to say touchy-feely, but that's not a good word to use. The church has kind of become, I didn't even plan that. The church has kind of become, it's become more quote-unquote liberal and progressive in the way that they do the mass and in the way they build churches, right? Churches now are kind of like theater in the round and all this kind of stuff, and they're brighter and there's less, you know, big statues and darkness and all that kind of stuff. But I'm sort of old school in that way that I think that's what a church should look like. A church should be old and dark with stained glass and big wooden pews, right? And the altar should be way up there. And this was the kind of church that I grew up in. And of course, above the altar, there was this humongous crucified Jesus, right? With blood and gore and all these things, right? And twice a week, I had to go to church and look at that. And you go beyond that. There's the resurrection, right? A man comes back from the dead. But he doesn't just come back from the dead, right? He comes back as this sort of ghost-like guy who comes through locked doors. And he shows up all the time talking in riddles. And the apostles are terrified every time he shows up, right? And then worse, and maybe this is the guy I could identify the most with in the story. Jesus shows up one day, right? And who's not there the first time he shows up? Did any of you go to Sunday school? Thomas is not there the first time Jesus shows up, right? And so Thomas starts shooting his mouth off, remember? And he says, he wasn't really here. I'll believe it when I can stick my hands into the nail holes, right? And all this kind of stuff, which is sort of morbid anyway, right? Well, so lo and behold, and this is what happens to people who doubt, right? Lo and behold, Jesus shows up again when Thomas is there. And actually, I think this is kind of cool. Jesus messes with him and says, okay, you can put your hands in the nail holes now, right? And you can believe that I'm really here. And of course, Thomas backs down and he's like, no, I believe. I would believe too if I got to that point, right? So you wonder why I spent my childhood afraid because of these sorts of things. But it didn't stop there. I'll also say that when I made my first communion, I received a book as a gift And it was the lives of the saints, right? It was the lives of the saints. And this was meant to... Now this again gets to the question of... This is the chicken and the egg thing, right? Did the material choose me, or did I just have this fascination beforehand? But I got the lives of the saints. And of course, I was supposed to read the lives of the saints, and I was supposed to realize these were role models for me, right? This is who I was supposed to be like in life. But I was fascinated by something else about the saints. I used to page through that book over and over again just to read the ways that they had died. Because they all died horrific, horrific deaths, right? And remember, these are the good people. They were martyred. This was the best thing that could happen to you, is that you would be martyred, right? So I would go through there and I would look. Stonings, beheadings, crucifixions. You know, St. Peter was crucified upside down. St. Andrew was crucified in the shape of an X. Boiling in oil, roasting on a grate, being skinned alive. Sort of starts to sound like a cookbook at some point. But wonderful stuff. I still wish I had that book because I thought it was really cool, right? So now I think we'd all agree, regardless of what our faith is or lack of faith or whatever, that our bodies are not who we really are, right? That our bodies, while they're important and we're dependent on them and all that, that's not our essence. You know, whatever makes us us is, if you want to say it's a soul or a spirit or a personality or whatever, our body is not the be-all and end-all of us, right? But there was and the idea would be that if you were this saint who got pummeled to death, right, it wouldn't matter what happened to your body, you would get your reward in the next life and you would be fine, right? And this was kind of the big thing. But the Catholic Church, you know, the church I grew up in, didn't always act that way. Now, until just about a decade ago, the church wouldn't allow people to be cremated. They're kind of okay with it now. But you know, the body was a vessel that took in the sacraments. And so if you destroyed the body in some way, then you were destroying the sacraments and all that. So just recently, they've been allowed to be cremated. In fact, about a year or two ago, I got a phone call from my parents, who never call me anymore. I got a phone call from my mom, and she just wanted to run it past me that it was okay. She was just telling me that she and my dad had bought their funeral. They prepaid for their funeral, and they were going to be cremated because it was cheap. But they were going to be, and I almost fell out of my chair. Like they're going to be put in a drawer together. They hate each other, but they're going to be in a drawer together. So it's this weird thing that the body is very important. And throughout my childhood, we would hear about these miracles, right, or read about them in Catholic school, where they would, and I don't know why they were digging these people up, but they dig up a saint, and the body would have not decayed. Right, or would have decayed minimally, and then they put the saint on display in a glass case, and you could go and sort of like, you know, and you know, and it would be really cool. So the lesson there is that the good people don't decay, right? You know, they're not like the rest of us, right? Now I remember he might torture them when they're alive, but he wouldn't let them rot when they're dead. Now I remember being about in the second grade, about the time I made my first communion. They took us all over to the church one day, you know, all the second graders, I think, who were going to make their first communion. And we were there, and they were going to tell us all this stuff about the church, like about the actual church building. I even remember the priest who did it. It was Father Carl. And Father Carl was the cool priest because he had a goatee and he drove a Mustang. So we all thought he was cool. You know, he was probably about 30 years old, so we thought he was cool. So he explained all this stuff to us. He said, you know, this is what the altar's for, and this is what the stained glass means, and this is why the church is shaped the way it's shaped, and what is on the altar, and what the vestments mean, and on and on and on. But then Father Carl made a huge mistake, right? Looking back, it was a huge mistake. He brought up the relic in the church. And if you don't know this, it used to be this way. I don't know if they still do it, but every Catholic church had a relic embedded in the altar. And a relic is a piece of a saint, like a bone, like, you know, Saint Sebastian's toe bone or a lock of hair from somebody or whatever, and this was embedded in the altar, right? So I raised my hand, and Father called on me, and I said, I want to see the relic. I want to see this. If there's like this human bone there in the altar, I, someone who's been dead for hundreds of years, I want to know what that looks like, right? I'm fascinated by this. And of course, Father said, no, we're not allowed to look at it, right? And he shut us down. But so again, there you see, I'm fascinated by these things, I'm interested in them, but there's always somebody saying, you know, there's a certain line you don't cross, and there's a certain places that are forbidden to go. As I was saying about the body, we live in a society that values the body, right? Whenever there's a missing person's case, the family at the very least talks about we want to recover the body, we want to have closure and that sort of thing. Now I hate the word closure because I really don't believe in it that much. I don't know. I mean, closure, I don't know that you can necessarily find closure for certain things, but we look for this in our society. We look for this sort of closure. And in a missing persons case like the one I'm talking about here, there isn't closure necessarily. It's open-ended. It's this blank screen onto which we can project whatever we want to imagine, right? What really happened to the person who has disappeared? Where is she? Is she gone because she wanted to be gone? Or is it because she can't come back? Is she being hurt? Is she suffering? What if she's right next door? What if she's right under my nose somewhere and I'm not doing anything about it, right? We live in a society that increasingly has more and more information at our disposal, so I think we should know everything, right? But there are still some things we don't know, and we're not allowed to know, or we're not able to know. And these missing persons cases, I think, are like that, and maybe that's what draws me to them, too, is that increasingly it's a thing that we're not able to understand in a world where it seems like we understand everything. And there's also something terrifying about the idea of disappearance, right? That an adult person can disappear and be gone. You know, we think we're safe to some extent, but someone can just be erased. You know, in 1984, they called them unpeople when people would be erased from the history books. They're unpeople, right? And so we all want to be remembered some way. We all want to be remembered. We want people to know that we're going to go on, that there's going to be a memory of us to go on. I have a friend who's a psychologist, right? He's not my psychologist. He's a friend who's a psychologist. If I wanted a psychologist, I wouldn't go to him. But he claims that everybody seeks what he calls an immortality project, right? We all want something that we think is going to make us live on after we're gone, right? Now, he says that one example is to have children, right? You have children, at least for a certain amount of time, somebody's going to know who you are. I mean, just tonight, I talked about my grandmother, who's been dead for 33 years or whatever, and has not made a mark upon the world, except that it was a Catholic family, so she has like 800 great-grandchildren now. But if we have children, perhaps we live on. Or maybe we look for these immortality projects somewhere else. Maybe we look for it as writers. Maybe we think if I write something that makes a mark upon the world, that somebody reads somewhere else, we'll be remembered. We won't just disappear, right? That there's a chance that somebody will be in a Goodwill store or a used bookstore somewhere down the road, and they'll find your book and they'll say, who is this guy? What is he doing here, right? So I just want to conclude with just a short little passage from The Girl in the Woods. And this is just, it's just a way to sum up. In the story, one of the characters is a college professor. He's a professor of folklore. And so he's sort of investigating this case on, the missing persons cases on his own. And he sort of sums up why there is folklore, like why do we tell ghost stories about people? Why do we have these legends about people who've disappeared and tell these stories? What are we looking for? So this is, and he's talking to his class. So this is what he says. You see, folklore often plays on our deepest fears as well as our greatest desires. We all wish to fall in love and live happily ever after, so we kiss in the gazebo and hope the magic works. Conversely, we all fear an early end to our lives, a snuffing out of all our hopes and dreams before we've had the chance to realize them. And if those hopes and dreams do get snuffed out early, we hope that there's someone there to help us pick up the pieces, someone to help us with our grades. Or maybe we just wish that some part of us lives on after death, wishing for the possibility of a reunion with the person we loved in life. Because the truth is, our lives don't always turn out the way we hope they will, and sometimes young people die, often in horrible ways. So now that you're all cheered up, I'll stop there, and if you have questions about the books, or about writing, or about life, I'm happy to answer them. Yes.
Okay, your first book was what I would consider more of a science fiction horror book. Where mm-hmm. were your experiences up here? Is this just from like the movies you watched? Or?
Oh, where did the idea for this come from?
The Condemned.
You're talking about The Condemned, which is available on Amazon.com. It'll be on sale after the event today. The Condemned actually came from a real-life experience, too. I mentioned growing up in Cincinnati, and I moved back, and I went to graduate school in Cincinnati. And the University of Cincinnati, if you've ever been there, is pretty close to the city. It's a pretty urban area. And we were living there going to graduate school, and in 2001, there had been a long series of unarmed black men being shot by the Cincinnati police. And the last time it happened, it led to civil unrest. I mean, people were rioting, people were smashing windows and looting downtown in Cincinnati. And so the mayor imposed a curfew on the city that you couldn't leave the house after 9 o'clock if you lived within the city limits. And it was the strangest, most surreal experience of my life to be in a city where there were usually people coming and going and cars and all sorts of stuff happening. But it was just dead. It was a ghost town. There was no one there. And we felt like we were locked in, because we were. You couldn't go out. In fact, we saw, like right when the curfew started, we looked out our window and there was a guy walking down the street. And I mean, the police were all over him. We saw the police pull their guns and chase him into an alley and all this stuff. So it started with that idea of kind of being in this dead, dying city and what could happen. Where does your imagination go from there?
Questions?
Got one over there.
Thank you.
I'm getting ready to write my first book. It's with Zach Coddington, I think, with Amazon.com. Terrified.
You're terrified of what? Of writing it or trying to get it?
I don't know. I haven't been through this.
Oh.
I did work at a newspaper, and it's similar to you. It's going to be called A Mother's Love, I'm just putting everything together, and I feel like every place that I've been in my life, I've been placed there for a certain reason.
Yeah.
And I've been telling people about things that I've gone through, and they said, this is not going to be one book, this is going to be a series.
Well, it'll keep you occupied for years to come, right?
Well, I'd like to get this first. They wanted this one in February, and I'm just, you know.
She's looking for tips on how to get published.
Yes, I've got people. I just today spoke to someone for an hour and a half interview. But,
okay. So the question is how to get something, a novel published, or like where to go?
How to finish?
Well, you can't publish it unless you finish it. So that would be my first piece of advice. You have to finish stuff. I would do that. In terms of getting it published, if you're looking at a smaller press, you can usually approach without an agent. You know, you can usually go right to the person, and they'll be open to submissions, and take advantage of contests and things like that that look for first books. If you live in Kentucky, Saraband Books, which is a really well-known publisher, has a contest once a year, right? Is it once a year?
Once a year.
They publish. It's only open to people in Kentucky. So So look for things like that. And then if you want to go bigger to like a New York publisher, you probably need an agent, and that would require, you know, all of the stuff is available in like the novel and short story writer's guide and the guide to literary agents, which are also on the shelves here, I'm sure. I don't get any royalties from them, so I really shouldn't be mentioning them. But yeah, I mean, I would just look at those books and research the market that way.
I've already spoken to Amazon.com. Person there, and he's offered to waive my fees to start it. But I asked him about a ghostwriter, and he said not to do that.
Okay.
Do it myself.
Yeah, you should do it yourself.
Back here.
Yes.
Tell us about your own writing. Do you write in the morning? Do you write in the evening? How many pages a day do you feel that you need to write in order to feel productive?
Well, because I teach at WKU, my schedule is different all the time, right? From semester to semester, it's a different schedule. But I try to write in the afternoon. I think it's important to do it at the same time every day, because I think you sort of train your brain to be ready to write at a certain time. And it's dependent upon what kind of person you are. I mean, there are people who say, I have to get up at 5 in the morning and do it, which I think is crazy. But if you're a morning person, go for it. And there are people who write all night. So I think you just have to find a routine that works for you based on your personality. I tend to write in the afternoon because, I love teaching. But when all the teaching crap is out of the way, then there's time to write. And in terms of the amount I write every day, I mean, I try not to be too locked into an amount, but usually it seems like 1,000 words a day, which is like 3 or 4 pages maybe, sounds reasonable. So I think just a little bit every day is enough to get you there. Yes, Dale.
Those jobs you had that weren't as writer, I thought I missed one. If you at liberty to tell this, because this is, I think, far more scary.
Yeah.
Didn't you work at the 2004 election, ballot boxes?
Oh, yeah.
I was a volunteer.
Isn't there a horror story there?
Yeah, you really want me to tell that?
I don't know. Is it quick?
I don't want to alienate my readers, Dale.
You have a psychoanalytical interpretation of where our material comes from. I just wondered, could that be material?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I think it could be great material.
Oh, yes.
I was a volunteer in the 2004 presidential campaign. I won't say which side I supported, because I welcome readers from the right and the left. You're all welcome to buy my books, okay? The apolitical, the tired, the indifferent, you can all buy them right here. Anyway, he's just referring to, my job was to follow the ballots to the Board of Elections, and the ballots took a detour and were loaded onto a truck by like some Russian mobsters or something like that. Anyway. The side that lost decided it wasn't important enough to do anything about it.
Right. Do you write by outline, or do you just have the idea and the words flow? You said you wrote 3 to 4 pages a day.
The question is about making outlines to write. I don't usually make an outline just because I'm not, it's just not my personality to make an outline. I think it's okay to do that. I think people have to figure out what works best for them. Some people need an outline to keep them on track.
So the words just flow. Pages just flow.
Yeah. After a couple of vodkas like this, everything just rolls right along. No, I like the thing that the reason I don't make an outline. I mean, I do make notes and I do have an idea of where I think it's going to go. But I think it's important for any writer, whether they make an outline or not, to be sort of open to the discovery that happens in the act of writing. That as you're writing, something might happen that you had no idea was going to happen. Like all of a sudden, you know, you get to a certain place and you're like, she died, you know, or no, he killed his mother, and you didn't think that was going to happen, but it makes complete sense at that point. So I think, outline or not, we have to be open to discovery as we go along, somehow.
David.
Yes.
When you were going through these childhood wanderings, did you ever just sit down and write about them as a younger person growing time after time?
So the question is, did I write about my chickenness when I was a kid? No, I didn't. I didn't write very much when I was a kid. I didn't. It's weird. When I was a kid, I read all the time. And I was an English major, and I read all the time. And I sort of had this vague notion that I would be a writer someday. But I didn't actually write anything. Some of you maybe have experienced this, right? I didn't actually write anything. I just sort of thought, well, that'll happen someday, right? And then it was between my junior year and my senior year of college. And I remember I was there, you know, it was in the summer, and I was there, and I was home for the summer at my parents' house. And I realized, holy, in a year, I'm out on my, right? And I've got to do something with my life, right? Like, I need a job. Which I hadn't, for some reason, that hadn't dawned on me. And I actually thought, well, maybe, like, do people get a job as a writer? Like, can that actually be a profession? And for some reason, it had never connected that way before. So as a kid, I didn't. Maybe it would have been therapeutic for me to do that, but I don't know.
Other questions? What are you working on next?
I've completed a sequel to The Condemned, which I want to send to Delirium, and I am also just now completing the 962nd revision on a new novel for my agent. So two things are completed, and then most importantly, this year an anthology that I co-edited with Molly McCaffrey is coming out from Main Street Rag Press called Commutability, featuring a lot of great stories, including a story by that bearded gentleman in the back of the room. Everybody turn and embarrass him. Jesse Nipley. You better applaud more for me. So anyway, so there's an anthology coming out that we co-edit. Thank you all for coming out. And
on behalf of WKU Libraries, we want to thank you for all coming in. We're going to do a book signing at that table right there. We'll be moving our books back there. Dave will be happy to sign them and chat with you. If you have any questions, please come up. And we hope you'll join us next week in our Faraway Places series when Michael Trapasso, our most traveled professor, along with David Keenan, will be here. And we'll be gearing up next year for another series in Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best. Thank you, and good evening.